In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast, is a carnivore diet bad for you? How to build more muscle with cold, the best baby food, microdosing with alcohol, and much, much more.
Health, performance, nutrition, longevity, ancestral living, biohacking, and much more. My name is Ben Greenfield. Welcome to the show.
Jay, dude, it's been a while.
Hey, man. Yeah, it has been a while. I feel like you pissed a bunch of people off last time because we didn't. It wasn't you. I think it was also, too, like the Clubhouse feed wasn't working. It was like down for everybody. And the world's completely melted.
Yeah, Clubhouse broke. I don't even know if people like it that we're using Clubhouse. But I mean, there's a whole bunch of people in the room right now. And for people who are tuning into this episode and aren't familiar with these Q&As, we, you know, Jay and I always pop in and we record the latest news flashes and answer questions. But we kind of got on this shtick a few months ago of just doing it live on Clubhouse. I don't even know the status of Clubhouse, if it's still like a respected social media platform or a thing of the past or what. But it is kind of fun to do it with a live audience just because you have pressure. You can't take pee breaks. You can't fart. You can't say anything inaccurate or you get called out. Well, it depends. It can be the silent, deadly variety. Later on in this show, we're going to open it up to any of you who happen to be live on Clubhouse right now, and we will answer all of your burning questions. And the other thing that we do on this show is, of course, the news flashes. And then also, if you go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com, if you're subscribed to the newsletter or you follow me on social media or anything like that, we always kind of push out on social media the time that we do these shows, even though it's usually a couple of Wednesdays during the month around 10:30 a.m. because neither of us like to get up early and work, nor do we like to work late into the wee hours. So we choose a sane time. So that's how these things work. And we usually just start off talking about anything we happen to be interested in at the moment. You know, Jay, I'm kind of into something kind of cool now. A new kick of mine. Ceremonial grade cacao. I've been really getting into it. Like, I've been doing a cup.
What ceremony are we? What are we celebrating here?
I don't know. I can't even say that I can give a proper definition of ceremonial grade cacao, though from what I understand, it is like heirloom cacao, meaning it hasn't been super genetically modified, like it's kind of the older, unadulterated variety of cacao, higher in some of the dopaminergic compounds and blood flow precursors like the methyl xanthines, which are stimulants that are produced by the cacao plant, and theobromine, which is that compound that naturally lowers blood pressure, but also acts as a stimulant similar to caffeine, but it has this real good feel good effect. Like it's dopaminergic. And of course, cacao is really rich in antioxidants and anti-inflammatory compounds as well. But somebody reached out to me on Instagram, shout out to I think it's called the Cacao Laboratory. And I'll put this out on my weekly roundup at some point because we recorded my family and I at like this 45 minute long cacao sipping ceremony that we did with Florencia, the nice gal from over there. And it to me was an excuse to drink super duper expensive hot chocolate. But it actually,
yeah, it's Christmas time.
Yeah. It has this really, really great kind of like feel good energizing effect. And I've been just throwing down a cup, frankly, because chocolate still has calories. And even though I like that, there's this drink I use sometimes and have been using for the past couple of years called My Cacao, which is like dried cacao shells and nibs. That's calorie free. And it's kind of like morning drinking chocolate. This cacao that you use for a cacao ceremony, you get ceremonial grade dark cacao bars. And then you chop them up and you pour hot water over them, and you can blend it if you want, or you can just use a whisk and stir the cacao into the hot water. and then you drink it. And so obviously, because you're using a cacao bar, and typically like, you know, a third to a half of a cacao bar, you've still got, you know, 200, 300 calories in a cup. So I typically don't drink it first thing in the morning. I'll usually drink it like later on in the afternoon or like pre-workout for a little bit of a pre-workout kick. But it's kind of cool. Maybe it's because it's Christmas time and cacao has that nice Christmassy Santa Clausy association, or maybe it's just because I'm coming up with a good excuse to have more chocolate. But I'm into ceremonial grade cacao now. I'm one of those cool people. So
I feel like you need to, just need to go get you some, you know, really cool marshmallows made out of gelatin, and then throw in some peppermint oil, maybe a little bit of,
crushed
candy cane up. Peppermint oil and some, you know, marshmallows. You'd
I do have a giant bag of vegan marshmallows up in my pantry. I don't know what makes a marshmallow vegan, because I was unaware up until the point that somebody gave me a bag of vegan marshmallows last week, that marshmallows actually involve the killing of animals. But
gelatin in marshmallow?
I don't know, but I'm sure probably. A true ceremonial cacao enthusiast would just withdraw in shock that I would do such a thing as bastardize my ceremonial grade cacao with marshmallows. But that's
like
a good idea.
It's like drinking a really expensive wine out of a beer mug or something.
That's
like
a good idea, though. And I like the idea of adding peppermint oil to it. I might just do that maybe tonight or tomorrow night or on Christmas Day and see how it feels. How about you? You been up to anything new lately?
Yeah, dude. Well, you know, I get shamelessly plug my new company, health technology company, Hanu Health. We've been, you know, running around like crazy, which means that we're moving and we're building and we're growing, which means like for me, I've been doing a ton of travel and I've had to kind of like remember how to hack travel again, because I don't know, like you, if like the last 2 years has been like, you know, mainly at home and not as much, you know, like on planes and in airports. So for me, it's been like re-educating myself on all of that, just because I've been going a lot from west to east, east to west, out in San Diego, back to, you know, South Carolina. And so it's just been an absolute like kill of fatigue and kind of all these things. So for me, it's been a lot of like re-education and then just utilizing movement and light and food as like the main, you know, zeitgeibers or resetters. And so that's been kind of fun to get back into. But it's funny because like I've been traveling a lot for the last 6 months and now I'm kind of just sick of it. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of want to just stay back at home again. So for the next like 3 weeks, I'm at home. So that's pretty nice.
There's all those hacks out there, like trying to get outside barefoot at some point in a few hours after you arrive at your destination. Or using intranasal glutathione spray to protect your immune system before you're getting onto an airplane, or, you know, doing your stretching exercises at the back of the airplane and being that annoying person blocking the pathway to the bathroom. But if you could name like the top thing that you would say has been a game changer for you for travel, or something unique you could share with folks, what's something you're doing when you travel to keep yourself put together?
Yeah. You know, one of the greatest things for me is eating at the customary time of the time zone that I'm in. So for instance, like if I leave here on the East Coast and I know I'm going to gain 3 hours, let's say, you know, I leave at 6 a.m. here and I arrive at, you know, let's say, you know, 10 a.m. there, it's 1 o'clock, you know, my time. Mm-hmm. And so for me, like I'm friggin' hungry. I'm ready to go.
It's lunchtime.
But exactly. So for me, though, I'm trying to delay my meals in order to kind of reset the clock, the circadian clock from the food that I intake. And so I'll eat, you know, again, around 12:30. And it can be really difficult initially, but I found that to be super helpful. And then the other thing is just prioritizing and optimizing sleep. And I know that sounds, you know, really, you know, just like, of course, duh, like that's ridiculously easy, boring, but that is the primary thing. And, you know, for most people who are very familiar with travel, whether it's, you know, domestic cross-country travel or internationally, like it's so much easier going west to east. I'm sorry, east to west. West to east is the tough one. Always coming back home for me is tough. And so that's where I find the biggest struggles. But thus far, like I'm adjusting pretty well to the travel game again. I try to limit it if I can, because I'm not a huge fan. Every once in a while, cool, but not all the time.
Yeah, you know, I'm a fan of that delaying mealtime until it's the appropriate mealtime at whatever destination that you're going to. But I do cheat because there's a compound that can kind of modulate the inflammatory pathways that inevitably get ramped up when you're traveling, when you're exposed to all the dirty electricity in airports and flying 40,000 feet above, you know, the earth, so you're not getting the grounding and the earthing effect and the stress from travel and the circadian disruption from travel. So I a lot of times will throw back a shot of these ketone esters before I get on a flight. Mm-hmm. Or when I get to where I'm going. And I mean, like, I can go 6 to 8 hours easily without eating with those. And there's a whole bunch of good ones out there now. Like, probably my top three. I'm not super duper brand loyal with these things, but three companies make amazing ketone esters now that just freaking work. HVMN has one. They've got this new one that's like a version of a 1,3 butane diol that's just
crushing your appetite.
Oh my gosh, that stuff's so good. And then it's a company really called Oxford has a good one, and then Ketone Aid. Like, all three of those companies, you can't go wrong. Like their ketone esters just work. You need one shot of them, and you do it like right before you get on your flight, or when you board your plane, or maybe when you get to where you're going, if it's going to be a few hours until you eat. And again, it kills two birds with one stone because it crushes your appetite, but it also manages a lot of the inflammation that occurs when you travel. And like, I'm a huge fan of those. I always toss a bottle of those in my airplane bag. Typically it's those. I got some electrolytes, a little bit of NAD, and that's kind of like my go-to travel Ziploc baggies, ketone esters, magnesium / electrolytes, and NAD. And I always feel better with those three supplements when I travel.
Yeah, the ketone esters have been huge for me in travel, so I've been doing that as well. And the other thing that I've really enjoyed that I'll do during the flight, I'll actually like drink it while I'm flying, is molecular hydrogen. And I found that to be extremely replenishing. It's kind of similar to what you were talking about in regards to, you know, magnesium and electrolytes, basically harnessing a lot of that value.
Yeah, that's funny you should bring that up. Literally like 10 minutes ago, Tyler LeBaron, who's one of the kind of like the top molecular hydrogen researchers in the world, he texted me two new studies on molecular hydrogen that just came out. One showing the benefits of drinking hydrogen-enriched water for cognitive performance, impressive results. Sweet. And then another one on controlling the inflammation from TBI and concussion. Both are pretty impressive studies published in the Journal of Integrative Neuroscience. So yeah, throw in a few hydrogen tablets in the mix isn't a bad idea as well. And I'll probably tweet out those studies soon so people can take a look at them. But speaking of which, we should jump into today's news flashes because we got a whole bunch of them since it's been a little while since we recorded.
Oh yeah.
All right.
Let's do it, man.
Let's do it. All right, so this first piece might seem like it's only relevant to those of you with small humans, aka babies, hanging around the house. But I think it's interesting nonetheless. And even though I don't have babies, I like to keep my finger on the pulse of nutrition from the age of when you pop out the vagina all the way up till death. And this story kind of caught my attention. It was in Fortune magazine, and it was about how the FDA basically tried to kind of shut down the marketing and the claims behind this infant formula company called Bobby. And what Bobby was doing was they were trying to develop what they called like a more European-esque baby formula that would be available in the U.S. because apparently parents who buy from Europe prefer baby formula that's more like lactose and coconut oil and grass-fed dairy formulas compared to like the palm oil and the corn syrup and the conventional dairy that you find in a lot of infant formulas in the U.S. And the FDA started to heavily restrict them to the point where they were kind of starting to shut down the profitability of this baby company called Bobby. And so I looked into it just because I think it's sad that we don't have access to better baby formulas that are more simulative of breast milk. here in the U.S., you know, and this is probably a topic near and dear to my heart, just because when my sons were born 13 years ago, my wife started an organic baby foods company very briefly, just for like a year.
I didn't realize that.
Her and my sister-in-law, you know, they had a local commercial kitchen, and they had all these like organic fruits and vegetables that they were blending up with different oils and then flash freezing. And my kids, of course, got raised on that you know, baby food, which was great for them, but they never really like took it big time. They were busy mommies, and it never really took off. But since then, I've always been interested in how can we fuel young humans to be healthier. So you know, for example, one company that I've really been a fan of for a while is a company called Serenity Baby Foods. And Serenity Baby Foods is a baby foods company. It's more kind of like almost like a paleo approach to infant formulas, where if you, mm-hmm. or not really formulas, but more like actual baby food, even though they actually have an infant formula now that they call their toddler formula, which is made from A2 milk, which is the form of milk with the protein in it that tends to be less allergenic and cause less immune issues in kids. And it's basically a bunch of grass-fed organic A2 whole milk and prebiotics, like, you know, human oligosaccharides and fructooligosaccharides. They add a bunch of DHA into it for the kid's brain. I actually have some that I keep next to my Nutribullet, and I literally toss a couple of scoops of that in my smoothie when I'm not doing like the Keon protein. Just as, you know, I have a few alternatives I put in my smoothie. It's a nice creamy, tasty formula, even though it was developed for kids like 12 to 36 months. It's a good toddler formula, but then they also do baby food, and their baby food's really good. Like, they have one that's like wild caught salmon with organic butternut squash and beets. They have another one that's like a bunch of different carrots mixed with these different oils that contain omega-3s and sixes and sevens and nines, and really well formulated baby foods. But I thought, you know, what the heck? I'll go look at this Bobby company and see what they're doing and see why the FDA would want to shut them down. And like, I gotta be honest, like, they kind of sort of did a decent job. Like, they put DHA in their baby food, which is fantastic for a kid's brain, and they've got some natural lactose and whey in there and some pasture raised dairy. But then I got my hands on the ingredient profile, and frankly, I'm not that depressed that the FDA is restricting them, because basically it's like non-fat milk. And non-fat milk is not what a kid should be drinking. Kids should be drinking like full fat milk. And then they have a bunch of safflower and sunflower and soybean oil in there. So a bunch of vegetable oils. Yeah, it's not like you know, palm oil or canola oil, but they've got a bunch of like, you know, traditionally rancid or heavily processed oils in there. And then some of the stuff is okay, like organic whey protein concentrate and organic coconut oil, a host of different preservatives I wasn't a huge fan of. They're kind of like, I'd give them like a 7 on a 1 to 10 scale in terms of the ingredient profile for their baby formula. But I mean, it's literally like a list a mile long of all of the stuff in there. And then I look at the ingredient list of something like the Serenity baby food stuff, and like, you know, I could read it to you right now. I wrote it down here. The Bobby formula is like lactose, non-fat milk, safflower oil, sunflower oil, soybean oil, whey protein, coconut oil, soy lecithin, calcium phosphate, potassium phosphate, sodium chloride, calcium carbonate, you know, zinc, ascorbyl palmitate, just a ton of stuff, some good, some bad.
Sounds conventional.
Yeah, but then the Serenity baby food, you look at the list on that, like the one I was talking about, the salmon, here's the list: organic butternut squash, wild-caught salmon, organic beet, water, and organic olive oil.
And that's five it. Ingredients.
Yeah. And so, you know, anytime I see a not quite a Frankenfood list of substances, but a pretty hefty list of substances compared to just like a pure, clean, plain Jane list, I'll typically go for the latter. But, you know, the long story short is that I think it's kind of sad that the FDA is limiting the supply chain and the ability to market for companies like Baby, like Bobby, who are trying to do a good job with an infant formula. It's at least a pretty good alternative to a lot of the Frankenfuels that are out there. Again, as we've established, not the best, but you know, it is interesting. I'll link to the article, but the long story short is parents out there, you know, and I'm knee deep in the process of writing a parenting book right now. So a lot of this is near and dear to my heart. Like, make sure you look at labels and go with companies like, you know, like Bobby or like Serenity Baby Foods. And I think it's just sad that the FDA has taken action against companies like this, because honestly, we need more healthy infant formulas out there.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Indeed. And it's like it's interesting to watch kind of what gets regulated and what doesn't and for what reasons. And like when I was kind of reviewing the article and reading through it just now, like, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's basically like they're saying that this company is targeting or saying that they're an infant formula when indeed like the FDA just doesn't classify them as an infant formula.
Yeah. Basically. Huh. Yeah, it's dumb.
Titles, but, semantics.
You know, related to that, there was an interesting study that came out on supplements. You know, my kids take some supplements. They take glutathione because they've both done genetic testing with the DNA company, and I think that's smart for kids. You can still keep the data somewhat private, but it turns out like my kids have the gene that limit their ability to be able to harness vitamin D from sunlight. So I prioritize making sure that they get adequate vitamin D intake. They also have the gene that limits their ability to produce adequate amounts of brain derived neurotrophic factor, which is kind of like Miracle-Gro for the brain. So they use a little bit of lion's mane, you know, like on their heftier mental days or days where they've got a lot of academic studies, they do a little bit of lion's mane extract. But this recent study looked at the effects of vitamin D and magnesium supplementation on the mental health status, in this case of attention deficit hyperactive children. But you know, you can kind of paint with a broad brush here and extend some of the beneficial effects on behavioral function and mental health of children with these two supplements to kids in general. And they did find a pretty significant effect, positive effect on mental health of children with vitamin D and magnesium supplementation. In this case, it was a pretty large amount. Like they were getting about 50,000 IU a week of vitamin D.
Oh, wow.
And about 6 milligrams per kilogram, which isn't a huge amount. Like 6 milligrams per kilogram a day of a, you know, guy my size is like, you know, 400, 500 milligrams of magnesium, which is a pretty standard dosage. But it turns out that that for kids, you know, even if you haven't had your kids genetically tested and you're not like dialing stuff in super specifically, it looks like for mental health and mental performance and overall cognitive health in children that making sure you prioritize either via dietary sources or even a little bit of supplementation, that based on this latest study, vitamin D and magnesium supplementation for children is not only healthy and safe, but it's also a good little hack for cognitive performance. And especially if you have kids who are showing like ADHD like symptoms, which in my opinion is really just the definition of a child in general, and especially a boy in general. Like I think a lot of boys who are diagnosed with ADD and ADHD should instead be diagnosed as active healthy humans, active health of healthy small humans with penises. Anyways, though, the
you got to throw in with penises,
right? Exactly. Just because boys tend to be a little more hyperactive than girls generally, painting with a broad brush. I have boys, and they just are. But anyways, regardless of whether or not your boys or your girls have ADD or ADHD or hyperactivity type of issues, I think that vitamin D and magnesium are two things that you should make sure they're getting enough of, whether via dietary sources or in this case, it appears to be safe to actually supplement with vitamin D and magnesium for kids. And you do that, you can buy it with like some healthy baby foods like that. And I think it's a pretty good 1-2 combo. So
Yeah, no. This is always an important one. I mean, one of the biggest things for us, you know, we have two boys as well. And especially during the summertime when they can get vast amounts of vitamin D, it's like allow them to exert the energy that they do have. You know, we call it ADHD. We call it, you know, just normal behavior. Like, you know, we place all these labels, unfortunately, on things. But I see it a lot of times with my boys. It's just normal energy and behavior that need to get out and they need to exercise. Get them outside in the sun, allow them to run around, play, lift and throw things, do whatever they want kind of in order to get sun and get activity. It's a great thing. But I think that, you know, when we get to this time of the year when there is the potential need for supplementation because of the lack of vitamin D, it seems like that could be a potentially a good route, especially for those who have just kind of high strung little ones.
Yeah. Supplementation for adults, though, not a recent study, but one that was brought to my attention as I was coming up in the holiday season and working on an article on like healthy cocktails and you know, modulating the effects of excess drinking and some things that would help out with hangovers. I came across a study. It was actually published back in 2002. But it was a good reminder for me that I think a lot of people will be happy to hear about this time of year, and it evaluated the effects of moderate alcohol consumption on C-reactive moderate. Protein, an inflammatory marker, and fibrinogen. And in this study, they had men and women, all healthy, non-smoking, moderate alcohol drinkers, consume, in the case of the men, four servings of alcohol. In this case, beer, and for women, three servings of beer, and they compared that to a control group using non-alcoholic beer. My apologies to that control group, because non-alcoholic beer, it's gotten a little bit better, but it still tastes like shit, in my opinion.
It still sucks.
Yeah, I'm not a beer fan anyways. But anyways, they looked at plasma C-reactive protein and fibrinogen levels, and they decreased by 35% for inflammatory C-reactive protein, and
that's
by
nuts.
Over 12% for fibrinogen. Two inflammatory markers in people who were engaged in moderate alcohol consumption. I've written before about the value of so-called alcohol microdosing, right? They've shown that higher doses of alcohol, of course, can cause alcohol-induced dementia. It can cause brain shrinkage, similar to excess THC consumption. It can cause impaired focus and memory because it affects blood flow to the prefrontal cortex, which affects your rational thinking and your short-term memory. High doses of alcohol have been shown to cause pretty profound brain inflammation in mice. Granted, these are like the equivalent of five to six drinks a day in human, and also in humans and rodent models, both have been shown to cause increased risk of stroke. But then you look at moderate drinking, and in this case, we're talking about the equivalent of around 1 to 3 servings of alcohol a day. And typically, it's around 2 to 3 in men, 1 to 2 in women. So this other study on beer I was talking about is actually a little bit higher than some other studies when we're talking about 3 in men and 2 in women. But basically, or actually that beer study, I'm sorry, it was 4 in men and 3 in women, like 4 servings of alcohol in men, 3 servings of alcohol in women. And most of the other studies I've seen are closer to like 2 to 3 in men and 1 to 2 in women. But they've found that people who consume that amount of alcohol are 3 times more likely than non-drinkers to live to the age of 85 or greater, a pretty significant protection against cognitive decline. In the case of red wine, a significant decrease in dementia. In rodent models, an increase in what's called glymphatic drainage, especially during sleep, like getting rid of inflammatory waste in the brain, decreased risk of stroke in people who are drinking 2 to 3 drinks of alcohol a day, lowered inflammation, similar to this other study that we talked about, and of course, the relief of mental stress and even a normalization of the cortisol response. You know, Jay, I've personally always been a fan of like having a nice glass of organic biodynamic wine at the end of the day. Like I drink the what's it called, the dry farm wine. I get a shipment of that dry farm wine to my house every month, and I haven't been drunk in probably it's been like 12 or 13 years now since I've been drunk or since I've ever had more than 3 drinks in a night. And yet I drink nearly every day a small serving of alcohol, and I'm more of like a 1 to 1.5 drink guy. Like when I say a glass of wine, I'm not doing the big old fishbowl glasses. Like I'm just having a moderate serving of wine. And I think that despite the fact that in health circles, people still say any alcohol at all is going to be bad for you, I really am convinced just based on the research that I've seen, because I pay attention to what the studies say. And I think most guys, even though I'm at like 1 to 1.5 servings of alcohol a day, I think most guys can justify 2 to 3 drinks a day, and women 1 to 2 drinks a day at least of a really good like organic biodynamic wine, or let's say like a really clean cocktail like a gin or a vodka combined with maybe a little bit of lemon juice or bitters or pomegranate juice or something like that. And I think the pros outweigh the cons over and over again. I mean, and a lot of people don't like to hear that because kind of like red meat, we just are we're conditioned to associate it with lack of health, just because we associate a lot of times, you know, the red meat thing with the, you know, football watching, beer drinking, McDonald's frequenting, you know, consumer. And in the case of alcohol, with the person who's, you know, whatever, drinking a margarita mix, you know, or two or three or four every night. But this idea of like moderate drinking or microdosing with alcohol, I think it's just fine, honestly.
Yeah, there's a lot of super interesting information and research out there. You know, regarding this study, there's a couple of concerns that I would have that I'm just thinking more anecdotally about me personally. The first would be that, like, the men were consuming four glasses of beer, which for me, like, four glasses just seems like a lot. I don't know if that's 4 pints, if that was like 4 8-ounce glasses. Yeah, I don't know what they consider.
Four glasses of beer would get me drunk. I can tell you that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a big guy. I mean, I'm 6'5", like 215. Like, even four glasses, that would be pretty, that just seems like I'd be pretty buzzed, or, you know, maybe even tipsy slash drunk off that. And so I couldn't see myself doing that much each night. And the other thing too, and I don't know if you've seen this, Ben, or experienced this as well, I would just be worried about like the nervous system repair and recovery aspect, because if I drink it in the evening, especially that much, even if it was three glasses, let's, you know, tamper it down a little bit. You know, I'm not as crazy to drink four, but if I drink three, then I would see kind of some significant disruption in my sleep architecture, especially in the realm of deep sleep, increased heart rate, and then decreased HRV. And those would be a little bit more concerning from a recovery standpoint, which is why I wouldn't drink that much. But I'm kind of more in line with you, like one and a half glasses a night seems a little bit more fitting. I would just be concerned if people hear this and they're like, okay, well, now I have the excuse of drinking four glasses of beer, four glasses of wine.
It's kind of like the weight loss studies that sometimes will look just at how much weight you've lost, but don't look at things like fertility, endocrine system, thyroid hormone status, etc. This study and many other studies will look at just 1 to 2 health parameters, like in this case, CRP and fibrinogen, or in other cases, other inflammatory markers or stress levels or something like that. But I would love to see a study where they're looking at lipids, they're looking at sleep, they're looking at inflammation, they're looking at the whole host of factors. And I suspect, as you've just alluded to, that what would come out of a study like that would be something closer to around, like, you know, one drink in women and 1 to 2 in men as being something reasonable as a daily alcohol intake. But long story short is that I wouldn't kick yourself too hard for having a few drinks a night over the holidays. It's not going to destroy you. I think sometimes it just gets blown out of proportion. So
agreed.
So there you have it. We just justified getting drunk over the holidays to all of our listeners. You're welcome.
If you could get drunk on one drink, yes.
That's right, for lightweights like us. But I can tell you that, kind of paradoxically, the use of anti-inflammatory drugs is something that you do need to be careful with. This is not a super new study. It's a couple of years old, but it crossed my desk last week, and it was something that I just decided I should bring up on the podcast, because I still see this, even in the health and fitness sector, as something that pops up over and over again. And it's this idea of the use of anti-inflammatory drugs. I'm just going to pop an ibuprofen. I'm sore after my workout, got a little headache, I'm going to take some Advil. We've established many times in this podcast in the past the increase in gut permeability and the impact on kidney function and the increase in the risk of toxin load and sepsis and a whole host of other issues with the moderate frequent use of anti-inflammatory drugs, like non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen or Advil, especially when we've got healthy alternatives like curcuminoids and termosaccharides and other compounds out there. This one for athletes showed that high doses of anti-inflammatory drugs basically attenuated the adaptive response to resistance training, meaning if you are lifting weights to maximize muscle growth or muscle strength and you're getting sore or you're taking anti-inflammatory drugs for some other reason, they really hold you back. They limit gene and protein expression of muscle growth regulators. We already know they do damage to the gut. And even if you're not concerned about that, or you've got an iron gut and you think your gut can take it, it just shows and has been shown over and over again, ibuprofen, Advil, etc., freaking significantly impairs skeletal muscle adaptations to exercise. And I still see so many people. I was at somebody's house. I'm not going to say their name, but they're like somebody who's in the health. And I went into their bathroom and I used their bathroom. There's one of those big old Costco-sized bottles of ibuprofen on the counter. And it's just like, I just don't understand it all down the toilet. No, when there's so many healthy alternatives out there, again, like curcumin, you know, I interviewed that guy named David Perez from that company Nourish, N-U-R-I-S-H. Mm-hmm. I'll link to that one in the show notes if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/438. I mean, like, the fact that people are still effing around with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs just shocks me. It's bad news bears, and especially if you're into fitness, it's not doing you any favors at all.
Yeah, it's no bueno. I remember back in the college bodybuilding days for me, like, we used to take ibuprofen, like, after, you know, a really hard leg day or just like a really hard push pull day, just because we were being big babies. And then also said, we thought, hey, you know what, we can recover faster, like, if we don't experience pain, almost like we'll work through it. Mm-hmm. And then it comes to, you know, with this study here and then all the studies that we've seen on this in the past, it's like, yeah, we were actually doing ourselves a huge disservice. And then so many people now just they take ibuprofen simply because it's palliative. Like, it's really helpful for them to kind of like get through the day if they don't have to think about or experience pain, instead of just kind of like learning to live with it and kind of allow it to be there. And I realize too, like, the chronic pain population or those who have chronic pain are probably like screaming at me as they listen to this. I'm not really, you know, referring to you. I don't think this is great for you either. I think there are much better strategies that are just healthier in general. But I think that we are so adverse to pain, like literally adverse to pain, that for a lot of us, we don't think twice before you know, we pop an ibuprofen, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, and anecdotal, admittedly, but it's pretty rare that I don't talk to somebody who has incorporated cold showers or cold baths or cold soaks as a regular part of their routine, who has not reported significant, not only increases in energy, increases in HRV, better sleep, it's better energy, but also lower levels of soreness and inflammation. And again, kind of a good segue into the next thing that I wanted to talk about. And that's this mm-hmm. idea that cooling enhances exercise performance. I was at a conference a few weeks ago with the folks who are working with the Stanford cooling glove experiment. Researchers, you know, with Dr.
Craig Heller?
Yeah, where they've developed this glove that enhances exercise performance when you circulate cold water around the hand because of these so-called, the anastomosis type of vessels that are in the hands and the feet, and you cool those and it does a good job. Yeah, cooling the rest of the body. A recent study in the Journal of Medicine and Science and Sports actually backs up this fact that cooling during exercise enhances performance, decreases your rating of perceived exertion, increases your ability to be able to push yourself because it can limit hyperthermia, which would cause faster central and peripheral fatigue and impair physical performance. But this was interesting because it showed that the area cooled actually matters. So for strength training, right, for anaerobic training where you're going really hard, it turns out that whole body cooling is the best way to enhance exercise performance, whether you're using something like one of these cool fat burner type of vests that you can wear. Shout out to coolfatburner.com. I think they have a big Christmas sale going on right now, by the way, too. So if you
those things
if you
are want to get sweet. These
vests, I know you just wear them while you're exercising. Cools the whole body while you're exercising. Jumping in a cold bath or a cold tub pre-exercise, or doing anything for whole body cooling is best for enhancing exercise performance that's hard. And then for aerobic exercise, it's actually these areas where you have these, how do you say them again, Jay? The arterio...
The AV shunts?
The AV IV shunts, but it's the arteriovenous anastomoses, I think is what you actually call these vessels that if you cool them, do a really good job cooling the rest of the body. And so this would be an example of using like a cooling glove or holding onto something cold or cooling your hands or your feet or even cold fluid ingestion, right? Like cold water or an icy or slurry or even menthol flavored beverage that's not even cold but has like a menthol minty cooly taste to it. That's better for aerobic exercise, right? Like endurance performance. So it kind of depends on the type of performance that you're doing. If you're going on a long run, you could like drink something really cold and then keep the face and the neck and the torso cold. And then if you're looking for more of like a strength training anaerobic effect, just like do a full body cold soak beforehand or wear some of this cooling garment during. And it's a really significant magnitude of effect on exercise performance. A guy named Brad Kearns wrote an article that I linked to. If you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/438, he wrote an article called The Unfrozen Caveman Runner, where he talked about, and he's like a master's level sprinter, how he really got into prior to his workouts at the pre-workout ice bath. A lot of us are used to like this concept of doing like the ice bath after workout to decrease inflammation or decrease core temperature. But doing it before, anybody who's done this, I don't know if you've ever done this, Jay, but if you like jump in a super cold tub before you go work out, you can crush it, especially if it's like a high intensity sprint-based workout. You got to be careful if there's a lot of biomechanical complexity, because if the joint's very cold, it can limit some of the nervous system recruitment. And, you know, so if you're doing like an overhead snatch and you're super cold, you have higher risk of throwing out a shoulder because you're moving the bar wrong, et cetera. But if you just prime yourself with something like a pre-cooling and then do a brief rewarming and then go into your all-out sprints, the reason for that is a scientifically validated 200 to 300% increase in norepinephrine that lasts for like an hour after cold exposure. So in this case, it's not being cold. It's more of the neurotransmitter response to the cold. And so it's a pretty cool hack as pre-workout to really allow yourself to push yourself a lot harder if you get cold right before the workout. And then you can warm yourself up a little bit just to make sure you're warmed up. Then go do the workout. And all those neurotransmitters are going to be circulating in your system for like an hour after you get cold. And Brad wrote a big article about this on my website, again, that I'll link to. But this idea of using cold is really interesting. And then there was an article that I wrote way back in 2012 for Lava Magazine. When I was racing in the Half Ironman World Championships in Vegas, I did a story for that magazine where I wanted to see what would happen if, and in this case, the race was at 109 degrees Fahrenheit, how I would perform and how I would do in terms of comparison to my previous races in the heat if I used, well, what I had in that race was I was drinking ice cold slushies during the race. I had the cooling sleeves, which are xylitol infused cooling sleeves that you wear on your arm. Huh. I had a cooling hat, same thing, xylitol infused cooling hat. And then I had a cooling vest that I wore during the running portion of the event. And then I also had these little like cold frozen handheld palm coolers that you hold in each hand as you run. And I'll link to the article. It's still available online for free at the Lava Magazine website. I'll hunt it down and put it in the show notes. But I literally was cool as a cucumber that entire race. And granted, you know, there are still issues with, you know, lactic acid and mental fatigue and physical fatigue from just pushing yourself. Yeah. But the heat was not an issue. I mean, a lot of heat is hackable with these type of cold exposure strategies. And this recent study shows that not only is it hackable, but depending on what type of exercise you're going to do, anaerobic versus aerobic, the area that you cool can have an effect. So again, long story short is for anaerobic, hardcore strength type of stuff, getting as much of the body cold as possible, then going and crushing it is better. And then if it's just for aerobic performance, literally just like drinking something super cold or cooling just the face or the neck or the torso has a significant effect.
This is some of the most fascinating and I would say exciting research and kind of research topic area that I've encountered over the past year. If you haven't listened to this, Ben, yet, or your listeners haven't listened to this yet, there's a great podcast that was done with Dr. Craig Heller, who is the guy who created the Cool Mitt out of Stanford and is doing a lot of this research on Andrew Huberman's podcast, so on the Huberman Lab. And it's so interesting. He's telling about these stories and these studies that they've done. where they've looked at kind of utilizing football players, both at Stanford and then professional football players, and having them just kind of during sets place their hands in these cool mitts or do these kind of like pre-workout soaks or pre-workout cold showers or cold immersions. And he was telling the story about this one football player who doubled his work volume in 2 to 3 days. So he was doing like, let's say like 40 dips like in one set. And then, you know, he would kind of naturally as his set progressions, you know, move forward, like he would lose strength as everybody would. And it's not to say he didn't continue to lose strength as set goes on with a cooling mitt, but he started to double his work volume like 2 to 3 days after using these mitts. So it's an incredible line of research. People can check out the Cool Mitt, COOLMITT. It's not available to the public just yet, just for professional athletes and I think Olympic athletes, but it's some incredible technology that I think that once it is available to consumers, it's going to like revolutionize the way that we do workouts. You're going to see everybody around the gym with their hands in these big old mittens.
And for now, you could just sprinkle a little peppermint oil in your hands and rub them together. And you know, if you have any leftover from your hot ceremonial drinking chocolate, yeah, don't rub your eyes.
Exactly.
Or your balls. So
yeah, true.
A few other things. I know we're getting a little long in the tooth on our news flashes, but I'll fly through just a few more for people that I think were interesting. Pretty darn good reason not to be dinking around with your phone before you go to the gym, like hefty use of social media, whether before you're working out or while you're at the gym. Multiple studies now have piled up, including this latest one about mental fatigue from smartphone use. We all know that it can be more difficult to, say, work out at the end of the day due to decision-making fatigue and the fact that just when you're mentally fatigued, you have a harder time physically pushing yourself. Well, this latest study looked at, compared to viewing a documentary prior to a workout, the use of a smartphone social network app prior to a workout, the smartphone social network app and dinking around in your phone for 30 minutes led to much lower volume load during a strength training session and increased perception of mental fatigue. And when you pair that with a ton of other studies, including one that was done in swimmers showing a significant decrease in swimming performance when people were doing social media prior to their swimming workout, the use of social media applications causing mental fatigue and impairing decision making in boxers. Another one that looked at the velocity of the bar with people who were engaged in social media prior to or during their workout in the weight room dictates that if you are still one of those people who's sitting on the bench in between your sets on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter, on TikTok, whatever, it's just not a good idea. I always have my phone in airplane mode. I always, if I have a workout that I got to go through, I always download it. And even like, you know, like I have, and I think I'd mentioned this on the podcast a few weeks ago, like I have a pretty massive fitness app. I partnered up with this company called Ladder. And so every week I've got like 6 weeks of programmed workouts, 6 workouts a week, you know, cues and tips and movements from me, a whole like chat room based around the workouts. But the fact is that the reason I like that app is it's got pocket control, meaning all of the cues that I give you as you're working out, everything I say to you, you could have your phone in your pocket the whole workout and not have to take it out and dink around with it. And anytime that you can do that and or have your phone in airplane mode, like I'm not against having your smartphone in the gym. It's great for counting. It's great for timers. It's great for if you have your workout written out or using a fitness app to be able to reference which exercise you're supposed to do. But specifically getting down to the root of the issue, social media prior to heading to the gym or while you're at the gym is basically going to make your workout less effective, period. There's like 8 research studies now showing this. So, you know, I just want to bring that up to tell people, freaking be careful. If you're listening to us on Clubhouse right now and you're at the gym, think twice, unless you're just kind of passively listening and not interacting. It's just one of those things that I would be remiss not to mention on the show just because I see people doing it so much. And it's just one of those things that's going to really detract from your performance.
Dude, totally. I mean, this is something I see every single day in the gym, and I've been guilty of it before too. Like, I'm not going to sit here and lie and say I've never done that. I mean, I've done it plenty of times, but I've really tried to change my behavior there, because you'll just watch people. They'll get in a workload or a work set, and then they'll sit on their ass and they'll be on the phone for, you know, 3 to 5 minutes on social media. And you know, these studies are really indicating this is a huge detriment to them. So the thing that I've been trying to do, I know I've mentioned on here on this podcast before and in other podcasts as well, is a kind of a tip and trick that my buddy Ben Pakulski taught me, which is, like, number one, get up, don't sit down during your rest. And then also just, like, do some breath work, like engage mm-hmm. in kind of that in breath work and parasympathetic activity. Like, it's so helpful for me, and I kill two birds with one stone. Whereas, like, I'm just getting dumber the more I like scan through social media. So I've really made it a habit now to put that aside, really kind of, I do have my phone on me because I've got my headphones in. I'm listening, you know, to a right. podcast or
some
music.
Yeah, I use it for podcasts or audiobooks or music. Yep.
Yeah, but not social media.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm the same way. I don't rest in between sets. I'll either do mobility exercises, I'll bounce up and down on my feet, I'll do breath work, but I don't sit at the gym at all. And exactly. You just get a much, much better workout that way. Even if you're recovering from a set of squats, there's no reason that you can't do a core exercise or an upper body exercise in between. I just think too many people just sit around too much of the gym, frankly. So
dopamine nation, man.
That's
dopamine
right.
Dopamine nation.
That's right. Okay. A couple of other things, and then we'll take a few questions here. The first is a recent study on the carnivore diet. I'll be pretty brief on this one. They looked at the nutritional practices and health status of a large group of carnivore diet consumers, over 2,000 people. They looked at gastrointestinal events, at muscular responses, at skin health and dermatology. They looked at lipids. They looked at glycated hemoglobin, blood glucose, use of diabetic medications, triglycerides, everything. Essentially, they found people consuming a carnivore diet actually had more health benefits and fewer adverse effects than people who were not consuming that. Granted, many people who are consuming any diet, whether it's vegan or carnivore or paleo or Weston A. Price or anything else, they're always going to be healthier just because they're more aware of what they're eating. And typically they're cutting out the standard crap that the average consumer is ingesting. And yet this did show, like, eating just meat isn't that big of a deal from a health standpoint, at least not short term. I think these people were eating this diet for around 6 months or so. Granted, this, like many studies, was a survey-based study. This was not a well-controlled laboratory study. Who knows right. how much kale and quinoa these people were cheating on with their carnivore diet. But regardless, they were reporting they were eating a carnivore diet. They tested a bunch of stuff, and they appeared to be just fine. So, you know, I'm one of those guys who has no issues at all. I think the average human could eat just meat, like a well-comprised nose to tail, bone broth, bone marrow, organ meats, red meat for the rest of their life and be just fine. My beef with the carnivore diet, is that it's just socially restrictive. Like, you know, when grandma brings over her green bean casserole for Thanksgiving and you got to be the asshole who doesn't eat it because all I'm eating is turkey, grandma. Yeah. Like, you know, or, you know, when you go to sushi, you can't have a seaweed salad, whatever. But long story short is this was the biggest study that I've seen to date on the carnivore diet and long-term adherence to the carnivore diet and any health effects that arise from that. Appears to be a moot point. I still think people who are eating a carnivore diet who are just eating ribeye steaks from Costco for breakfast, lunch, and dinner are going to build up nutrition deficiencies over time versus people who are eating a more well-comprised nose-to-tail carnivore diet full of organic, wild-caught, pasture-raised, grass-fed, grass-finished meats and organ meats and bone broths and bone marrow and the like. But ultimately, long story short, carnivore diet, not a big deal. So,
from
a health standpoint. Yeah. And then the last one was sleep duration. We all know that 7 to 9 hours is the recommended level of sleep for most people, with anywhere from 6 to 7 hours plus a nap or a siesta or a meditation session also being another way to ensure that your sleep architecture is good. And that's really my jam. I sleep 6 to 7 hours a night, and then I do a 20 to 45 minute siesta right after lunch. And that works just perfectly for me. But this latest study suggested that long sleep duration is just just as bad as short sleep duration, especially for cognitive frailty and mental deficits. So unless you are a professional athlete with a higher amount of neuromuscular recovery implications, sleeping or being in bed for more than 9 hours a night seems to have just as many health risks as sleeping less than 6 hours a night, dictating the fact that more is not better. I think a lot of people are already aware of that, but normal sleep duration, again, 7 to 9 hours a night or 6 to 7 hours a night, plus a nap or a meditation session or a siesta or one of these like yoga nidra type of full body scans where you're just laying there for 30 minutes, totally relaxing yourself. Like that's pretty good. But what you want to avoid is sleeping less than 6 hours or being in bed slash sleeping longer than 9 hours. Latest study just came out, showed a particularly increased cognitive frailty. And this was over 4,000 participants in this study. This wasn't a rinky dinky, like, you know, nine healthy women in Cincinnati study. Like this was a big, big study, in this case in China. And so just be careful with sleeping too much. I think sometimes in the biohacking health, you know, orthorexic dieting, you know, sector that we just tend to sometimes think, oh, the more I can sleep, the better. And if I can sleep 12 hours a night, I'm going to really rock it, baby. Fact is, you're going to waste a lot of your life, comma, you're not doing yourself any favors in the health department, especially once you exceed about 9 hours, unless, and again, you're unless you're a professional athlete. You know, if you're training 3 to 4 hours a day, you just need more neuromuscular recovery. You need more lymphatic drainage. You need more musculoskeletal recovery. You need more sleep time. But unless you fall into that category, like, don't be sleeping like a pro athlete if you're not a pro athlete. I mean, don't short yourself on sleep. But anybody out there sleeping more than 9 hours, you may want to check yourself.
Do I just sound completely pompous that I think or feel, I don't know what would be the better word here, that sleeping more than 9 hours just seems like an absolute waste of time? Like, it just seems like such a waste of time to me.
It is kind of venturing into the don't waste your life type of category. I mean, right. There's a reason. What's that saying that the most impactful people are tired people? It's something like that. Yeah. Like if you look at all the world leaders and movers and shakers and inventors and entrepreneurs and people who are really making an impact in this world, yeah, they kind of die and go to their gravestone a little bit tired with some bags under their eyes. And honestly, I think that's okay. Right? Like, it's okay to short yourself on sleep if that allows you to make maximum impact with your life. I don't think you should be like the Navy SEAL who says, I'm going to sleep when I die. Yet at the same time, I think some of us just like protect and prioritize our sleep almost too much, when in fact, we might be able to create more, make greater impact, spend more time with our kids, learn a new musical instrument, etc. We just slept a little bit less, you know, and again, we got to strike a balance. But yeah, I think a lot of times, you know, podcasts about biohacking and health and sleep and exercise, etc. Some people just get too worked up about the sleep component, you know, and again, like my sweet spot, 6-7 hours a night. I go to bed about 9:30. I get up between 3:45 and 4:30 a.m. I get a wonderful, you know, 4 to 5 hours of work in before, you know, half the world is awake. I've got half the work day in. I slip into the basement right after lunch and take a 20 to 45 minute siesta. I'm good to go, and I'm far more productive with that versus like, you know, sleeping from whatever 9:30 a.m. till or 9:30 p.m. till 6:30 a.m. I always feel like I'm wasting my life, and I'm always playing catch up when I sleep that much.
Agreed. It's not too dissimilar from my schedule.
All right, well, let's take a few questions. I know we've been going a little bit long already, but let's do three questions. We'll keep our responses maybe not super duper long in the tooth. We'll do a little Q&A here. Let's do it. All right, we got Harrison. Harrison, what's your question, man?
My question is, you were talking before about cold therapy before workouts. And I'm wondering if you have seen this either with clients or in your research, the testosterone increase before workouts with cold therapy. And if so, do you agree or think that cold, like a shower, cold therapy, cold shower before a workout is enough to evoke that response?
All right. So the link between cold therapy and testosterone, we already know there's a link between cold therapy and sperm, and that, you know, icing one's balls, avoiding excess heat, hot tubs, etc., has a pretty significant effect on sperm morphology, a positive effect on sperm morphology. But they have done some studies on salivary testosterone levels, particularly as a response to a cold shower or a cold plunge or a cold dip. One recent study actually looked at it was like a Swedish study, and they looked at men who were doing like a cold glacial water dip prior to exercise, and they did see a significant boost in testosterone. The folks from that cool fat burner company that I talked about earlier, they've also had some internal studies where they've seen increases in salivary testosterone in response to cold exposure. There was another pretty recent study that was published in the spring of this year where they looked at testosterone, they looked at cortisol, they looked at DHEA, and they found that in men who were doing a sauna with cold versus just the sauna, that the cold had a much bigger effect on endocrine function, particularly in testosterone. And there's a lot of other smaller studies that have looked into and found cold to increase testosterone. How long of an effect that is, like whether it's just a quick acute effect or whether it's a long-term chronic effect, is tough to say because most of these are looking at pretty immediate salivary response to cold. But long story short is that I really do think there's something to this idea of cold and the positive impact on testosterone and endocrine function, and seemingly a significant increase in sperm count and fertility as well. So I'm going to go thumbs up on that. You got anything to add, Jay?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the interesting things that came out of the lab in Stanford from Dr. Craig Heller was looking at the effects of an increase in adrenaline and epinephrine and how that relates to testosterone. And as we know, kind of from basic physiology, is that we see diminished testosterone with chronic enhancements of adrenal fatigue or chronic enhancements of adrenaline release. However, in the short term, what we found and what they found, I shouldn't say we, I'm not a part of the group, is that as people kind of transiently or acutely increase adrenaline, that testosterone also will increase as well. So I think that there's an interplay between testosterone and adrenaline, and I would think that that's probably the major modulator there. But again, maybe more research needs to be done on that end.
Awesome. Cool. Easy reply. Thanks. Good question, Harrison. All right. Let's bring somebody else up.
Good morning and afternoon, everyone. Thanks for doing this great room. I'm just wondering, I don't know if you're going to want to answer this or not, but what do you think, and it's not really to do with sports nutrition, but what do you think about the vaccine and its effects and what people can do to kind of, you know, not detox, but actually get themselves into a, you know, get some of the items out of your system. And if you don't want to answer this, I totally get it because I'm in the health field too. I do a radio show on iHeart Boston Providence, and I kind of stay away from this subject myself because I don't want people to do what I do. But I'm just wondering your thoughts on that.
Yeah, sure. I did a whole podcast with Dr. Matt Cook about this, and I'll link to it in the show notes if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/438. But we went over all of the things that he does to support any type of deleterious response to the vaccine with his patients. And in particular, even though I have that whole document for free, if you go to the show notes of my interview with him, the main things that he uses is hydrotherapy, meaning alternating hot and cold applications to improve the circulation of blood and lymph via peripheral vasodilation and vasoconstriction, which allows for removal of waste products from tissues. And then he uses a host of different supplementation, primarily mixed vitamin E, tocopherols, and tocotrienols. Like Designs for Health has a good vitamin E product that mixes the tocopherols and the tocotrienols, which can help with blood clot prevention and lowering of blood viscosity and cell membrane protection. A ton of liposomal vitamin C. Vitamin A, which actually upregulates the toll-like receptors in the GI tract, which can help to modulate the immune response. Vitamin D3, also to help both the innate and adaptive immune responses, so you almost get like a better response to the vaccine. Vitamin B5, which allows for better histamine clearance in people who have a little bit of a mast cell activation response to the vaccine. something called Pro Resolving Mediators, which help to keep some of the accelerated inflammatory response that can cause like a long-term side effect to the vaccine at bay. Some binders, particularly activated charcoal and bentonite or zeolite clay, to help remove some of the chemical toxins and adjuvants that may be in the vaccines. He actually uses a homeopath called Thuja, another one called Arnica, and primarily just does that for the arm pain and the body aches that you can get from the vaccine. A special type of mushroom called agaricon mushroom, which helps with the what he called the broad spectrum antiviral polypore, which apparently again improves the immune system response to the vaccine. Grapefruit seed extract to improve the blood vessel wall and endothelial integrity. Higher dose melatonin to decrease the inflammasome response to the vaccine. Resveratrol to help stabilize the mast cell and the histamine response. Astragalus, which also helps with the inflammatory response, but in people who are having a severe inflammatory response, apparently you need to be careful because it may cause some issues with that. A few different adaptogens, primarily holy basil and rhodiola. And then he uses colostrum to help to protect the gut and increase the production of immune-activating antigens in the gut. And then NAD or NMN or NR as mitochondrial protectants and IV glutathione for the same reason. And then finally, he uses a whole range of different injectable peptides, with probably the most notable for the immune system modulation being thymosin beta 4. And I know that sounded like a lot of stuff, but that's all written down and that's all a free download in the podcast show notes that I have with him. If you I'll just link to it if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/438. But I actually have Matt coming on another podcast in about a week, because since the podcast that he did with me, in which he was pretty bullish on the vaccine, he said about a week after that show, he started getting people right and left coming into his clinic who were like blind from the vaccine, people who were like getting paralysis. Whoa. And like all sorts of serious issues. So we're having another discussion in about a week, but his clinic has pretty much blown up and kind of like become a clinic that was primarily treating COVID patients to a clinic that's primarily treating people with vaccination symptoms that are almost like more problematic than COVID. So we're going to have a pretty interesting discussion, I guarantee. But in the meantime, should you need to get the vaccine or should you have been vaccinated and be concerned about some of the side effects, I would definitely access that document. So good question, Meg.
Oh no, that was awesome. That's so great. I'm going to definitely go and watch the show, and you know, you're preaching what I'm preaching, and we just need to get the word out there. Isn't it funny how the these cases where people have had injuries, they're not getting onto the news, you know, and it just, it bothers me, because I myself was forced to get the vaccine. And when I say forced, that wasn't a gun held to my head, but the Department of Health in the state of Rhode Island told me I need to get both vaccines, or I would have to present myself in front of the board and all this crazy stuff. And then it also said at the end of that letter from the Department of Health, if you know anyone that is licensed in the state of Rhode Island who has not gotten the vaccine, please report them here. So I'm like, I do a radio show. I knew somebody was going to report me, and I did get tachycardia after it. So,
yeah,
but I want to thank you so much, Ben.
Yeah, no problem. And I can say I'll probably get vaccinated, but I'm waiting for Novavax or Inovio. So I would like to get vaccinated just to protect myself against any variants, and also to get rid of any of the problematic social restrictive issues. But I'm waiting for one that I'm more comfortable with to actually get the jab, so to speak. So, all right, well, let's take one more question. All right, Sharin, last question. Make it a good one.
I myself am an autoimmune transformational specialist and do a bunch of fun stuff, and I work with clients. And a lot of women listen to your podcast, and they come to me and they're like, hey, I was listening to Ben, and I'm going to do the carnivore diet, or they start intermittent fasting. And what happens is their period, their cycle goes crazy. And I just wanted you to touch a little bit on, you know, some of the contraindications of the carnivore diet for women, If you've come across any, what your take is on how they affect female hormones, and what women can do to prepare if they do want to do a diet or they can better support their cycle.
Yeah. So first of all, agnostic of the type of diet being consumed, many people who begin to diet also begin to fast or restrict calories. It's just the nature of being more aware of what you're eating and the timing of what you're eating. And especially in premenopausal women, there's a significant downregulation of a hormone called kisspeptin. I actually have some injectable kisspeptin in my refrigerator upstairs because it's so great for fertility and for testosterone. And so you can imagine that if that particular hormone were to decrease in women, what would happen? Well, we see a decrease in luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone. And lo and behold, what's one way to significantly downregulate kisspeptin? Not eating for longer than 12 hours in premenopausal women. And so first of all, longer term intermittent fast, longer than about 12 hours in premenopausal women, especially when frequently performed, is not a good idea. I'm a bigger fan of a 10 to 12 hour overnight fast for premenopausal women. And because all those autophagy, cellular cleanup, longevity benefit effects don't kick in until after about 16 hours, then what you do is just a couple of times a month, do like a 24-hour dinner time to dinner time fast. So you're not frequently making a big dent in endocrine and fertility function, but just every once in a while, you're getting those autophagy benefits. So first of all, don't excessively fast. Second of all, decreased adequacy of carbohydrates can impair the conversion of T4 into T3, can also increase cortisol, and can impair endocrine function. And because a carnivore diet, just by the nature of the diet, tends to be lower in carbohydrates, inclusion of things like berries and honey and like healthy, and I would even say if you're willing to kind of like bastardize the carnivore diet and even do like some safe starches like tubers, you know, sweet potatoes, yams, purple potatoes, etc. Most of the women who I help out with their diet, they're having minimum of 100 and typically close to the 200 grams of carbohydrates a day. Typically from sources like that, like berries and honey and tubers, and even those eating a carnivore diet are also doing that. And that seems to really, really help out with the fertility part. Now, the nice thing is if you do those things, if you don't excessively fast and you eat adequate carbohydrate, if you're eating a well-comprised nose-to-tail carnivore diet where you're getting like bone marrow and bone broth and a ton of omega-3 fatty acids and even saturated fats and pregnenolone precursors for things like progesterone and DHEA, then what's going to happen is actually a pretty beautiful scenario. It's a little bit more to like the Wesson A. Price diet. If you Google the Wesson A. Price diet and look at the parameters of that diet, it's like a bunch of full fat dairy and fermented vegetables and butter and lard and pastured meats and, you know, kind of a wonderful scenario for fertility and for overall endocrine function. And really the carnivore diet is almost just like a stripped down version of that that gets rid of some of the fermented vegetables and some of the spices, et cetera. And so I have no issues with the carnivore diet as far as women are concerned. I would just say that for endocrine function in general, don't excessively fast. Make sure you're eating a properly comprised nose-to-tail version of it, and then open yourself up to the idea of including honey and berries and tubers and somewhere in the range of about 100 to 200 grams of carbs a day minimum for most healthy, active females is a pretty good target to shoot for. And then if you're going, you know, if you're in for the longevity and the autophagy game, just toss in a couple of times a month to a 24-hour, like a dinner time to dinner time fast. And that's the strategy that I would use. So the only last thing I'd throw in there is if you're postmenopausal, nice thing is it actually is healthier to do like these 12 to 16 hour intermittent fasts. So it kind of depends on the phase of your cycle and where you're at as far as menopause is concerned. But that's what I would be doing as far as the carnivore diet goes and endocrine function and fertility. So I hope that's helpful, Sharon. Good question.
Yeah. Now, or you just need to, you know, quit screwing up women's, you know, menstruation cycles, Ben. I mean, you're causing some difficulties here.
Yeah.
But no, there seriously was something that I did have to say that was serious, which is there are two podcasters that I don't necessarily listen to as much for my own health because they're very women-centric. But one's actually a Keon coach. Her name's Angela Foster. cannot remember Angela's podcast name, but it's really great because it focuses on specifically biohacking for women's health. And then there's another podcast by Lauren and Renee, which is called Biohacker Babes. And I just try to send a lot of women that direction just because that's not my area of expertise. But if your clients, I don't know if it's Sharon, if your clients are really interested in overall women's health and biohacking of women's health, they are really great resources. And they basically try everything that they suggest, kind of similar to Ben, that immersive level of journalism. So I was just going to throw out their recommendations as well.
Awesome. Cool. Well, I dig it. Well, we've gone through a lot. Let's give something away before we take off. So we haven't done this for a while, so we should do it. But the best way you can support this show, because you know it's a big labor of love. We put a ton of time just in the show notes alone. Like, we have really good show notes. If you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/438, you'll see what I mean. Like, we spend a ton of time on the show notes. We have to have an audio editor or goes through and cleans up all of our crap because Jay and I are total audio amateurs. And so basically, the best way to support the show is to leave us freaking reviews or give us your credit card number and just slip that to us under the table. But safer, just leave a review. Go to wherever you listen and just pop it super quick. It'll take you 5 minutes. Leave us a review. If we see your review and we like it and we read it on the show, we're going to send you straight from my front door a gear pack, a cool tech exercise t-shirt, a cool beanie, great for this time of year, and a BPA-free water bottle and some other goodies. So if you hear your review right on the show, which is about to happen, just email your t-shirt size to gear@bengreenfieldfitness.com. That's gear@bengreenfieldfitness.com, and we'll get something out to you. So that being said, Jay, you got a review to push out?
Oh, yeah, man. It's Christmas time, so I gathered 10 reviews that I'm going to read today. No, not really, but I do have a really good one from April B6, who titled this as top-notch science-based content. So April said, love, love, love that I can get the most updated information on how to upgrade my health, and it's also entertaining. That was my favorite part of the review. So thanks, April.
Short and sweet. I dig it.
Oh, April, no. I love it.
Email us, April, gear@bengreenfieldfitness.com. We'll get a goodie bag out to you. And the rest of you, leave us a review. Leave us a ranking. Just do it. Come on. Holiday season. Now is the time to give. To give gifts and ugly sweaters and useless socks and reviews.
And drink alcohol.
That's right. And drink alcohol. All the show notes are at bengreenfieldfitness.com/438. Check them out. Jay, I'll catch you on the flip side. I'm going to go hunt me down some drinking chocolate.
Do it, man. Peppermint and oil and all.
Vegan marshmallows. I got it. I took my notes. All right, you guys. Later. In compliance with the FTC guidelines, please assume the following about links and posts on this site. Most of the links going to products are often affiliate links, of which I receive a small commission from sales of certain items, but the price is the same for you, and sometimes I even get to share a unique and somewhat significant discount with you. In some cases, I might also be an investor in a company I mention. I'm the founder, for example, of Keon LLC, the makers of Keon-branded supplements and products, which I talk about quite a bit. Regardless of the relationship, if I post or talk about an affiliate link to a product, it is indeed something I personally use, support, and with full authenticity and transparency, recommend in good conscience. I personally vet each and every product that I talk about. My first priority is providing valuable information and resources to you that help you positively optimize your mind, body, and spirit. And I'll only ever link to products or resources, affiliate or otherwise, that fit within this purpose. So there's your fancy legal disclaimer.